This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. More and more Americans are living in multi-generational households, three generations or more under one roof. People do this for financial reasons, emotional reasons, or both. But many were not expecting to be living this way at this time. Our colleague David Green has been getting to know three families like this, and we're going to spend much of the next 8 weeks with them in a series called Family Matters. That's because these families face almost every kind of financial decision, including possibly decisions like the ones you face. David Green, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve.
So who have you met?
These three families you mentioned, they're really living out these stresses and pressures in so many different ways. And I want to get right to their voices so you can really get a sense for who they are. And let's start in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And you're going to hear now the voice of an 87-year-old woman named Annabelle Bowers. Her family calls her lovingly Snootsy. So she has two granddaughters who have literally opened their homes to her. She lives half her time with one household, half with the other. These are families, Steve, that are dealing with all these other pressures. You know, how much money to put away for retirement, how to pay for college for their kids. And Mrs. Bowers, she knows she's adding to their pressures. And when I spoke to her, she did something that we've actually been hearing a lot. She broke up the tension in the room with a little bit of laughter.
How do you feel when you see your family taking care of you? Like,
Well, I hate it. I just feel like I'm a burden, but the girls don't even think that way of me. I make their day. Miserable, but I make it.
So, Steve, we'll get to know that family. Now let me take you to another family in Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C. There's a 24-year-old named Nicholas. He's living at home. He was exploring this career in the arts, but when his grandfather, who's in his 80s, started really suffering from dementia and moved in, Nicholas has been thinking about trying to find a career that'll make him more money so he can help out with the family. And everything is so fragile under this roof. Nicholas had a friend staying over one night, and when his grandfather, who has dementia, woke up and saw this unfamiliar face, it just threw the whole day off.
I had a friend on the couch, and Grandpa came out of his room. He automatically asked, "Who is that?" And that was what threw everything off. So from that point on, it was, "No, I'm not getting in the car. No, I'm not going to daycare. No, I think I'm going to stay here today," like whatever the case may have been.
And threw everything off, Steve, meant that family members had to decide whether to skip work that day, to take care of Grandpa, and that brings with it all sorts of questions about, you know, making money that day. And finally, the last family we're going to meet is right outside Baltimore. It's these three generations of women, and in the middle is Geneva Hunter, and she lives with her 90-year-old mom who has fallen ill. And Geneva is dealing with a lot of emotions. But one, she's watching her mom fade away, which is something that so many people in her generation are confronting today. But she's also watching her own daughter sacrifice everything, including a job, to be the caretaker, to take care of her grandma full time.
I've always wanted the very best for her. I want it even more now. I do want her to go back to work and be happy. I want her to have her life back.
And so, Steve, just some of the voices we'll be hearing, those are voices from three different families who will be following.
Amazing. You hear people having to change careers, people missing work, people going through this process of slow, slow grief. Is this something that any of your families expected to happen to them?
No, and that's really what we've been hearing about. I mean, families can do all the preparing and think that they're on top of everything, but when an elderly family member falls ill, when something happens, there's this flashpoint where you have to decide, you know what, the best option is just to bring everyone together under a single roof. All the financial questions, all the emotional stresses, these families say they just had no idea what to expect, and they weren't prepared.
Well, maybe this series of financial stories over the next 8 weeks is going to help a lot of people in that situation and inform many people besides. David, stay with us. I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Paul Taylor is Executive Vice President of the Pew Research Center. He's been doing demographic research on families like the ones we've been hearing. Is that right, Mr. Taylor?
Yes, we have.
How common are the stories you just heard?
It's becoming more and more common. We estimate that about 1 in 6 Americans live in multi-generational family households. That's 54 million Americans. If you go back 30 years to 1980, only 28 million Americans. Hmm. So this phenomenon has doubled in size in the last generation or so. And it has been spurred in recent years by the rotten economy that a lot of people are having to cope with.
People just can't afford to live independently. Children can't get jobs and older folks can't stay independent.
And you know what? It turns out to be a very successful unofficial anti-poverty program. families living in these circumstances, if you look at their overall median income, it is lower than the national average, but they also have lower poverty rates. They have figured out a way to pool resources, to make do, and to stay above a floor of poverty, better than other Americans in their same economic circumstances.
Now, let's not assume it's all bad. There can be something heartening about this. You're staying close to your parents. You're staying close to your grandparents. But it's also given rise to this term, the sandwich generation. What is that?
The sandwich generation are people in middle age, and it happens to be a very large generation. That's the famous baby boom generation that was born right after World War II, 75 million. They're in their late 40s to their early and mid-60s. And they have a greater likelihood than any other generation their age to have living parents. They also have a greater likelihood to have not only minor children that they're still caring for, but young adult children they're still caring for, because we have the phenomena of either the boomerang generation or the never-launched generation, the 22-year-old, the 28-year-old, the 30-year-old who's having trouble finding that first job. So the caregiving is not done grudgingly. The caregiving, as you say, is generally done quite lovingly.
Mm. Now, we got started on this series because people here were talking about financial literacy, about the difficulty people have in navigating the increasingly complicated financial decisions that they face. How knowledgeable do you think people are about the financial decisions that they're making and that they have to make day to day?
You know, my guess is, from looking at the data, that people who wind up in multi-generational family households weren't expecting it, weren't planning for it. But, you know, there's a great line from Robert Frost, "A home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in." Hmm. People run into circumstances, whether they're older and they're in failing health, whether they're in middle age and they've lost a job or their homes have been foreclosed on, whether they're young adults and they can't get started, and they have to adjust. It is the ultimate social safety net. I think some of it has to do with a tougher economy, so you have to double up. Frankly, some of it has to do with the fact that in terms of money, most of the household wealth in this country is parked at the upper end of the age scale. There's a lot of wealth. This is the healthiest and wealthiest generation of older people we've ever had. So while there is a lot of caregiving that boomers give to their elderly parents as their health begins to fail, there's also a tremendous amount of financial assistance that the elderly parent gives to the boomer.
So we're going to be learning right along with these families and with NPR's David Green, who's still with us. And David, where do we go next week as we begin this 8-week journey?
Steve, we're going to spend some more time with the Shimon Gilmore family from outside Washington, D.C., and that's the family of Nicholas, the 24-year-old you heard from. And it's interesting, I hear Paul Taylor talking to you about this idea that the caregiving is not being done grudgingly, it's being done lovingly. And one of the real questions that this family faced and a lot of families in the country face is, you know, if you decide to think about a nursing home or, in this case, an adult day center, you know, if that's the reality for your family, you have to do that because you can't care for an elderly parent, you know, 24 hours a day. You need to keep a job. But can you still offer loving care to this member of your family while using a facility like that? And we're going to take a trip into an adult day center in Maryland. And so that's what we'll be exploring next week.
Looking forward to it. David Green is our correspondent. Paul Taylor of the Pew Research Center is with us here. And the series is Family Matters. You can follow the series online and see photos of all the families we're following at NPR.org.
When trying to solve a problem, many Christians ask themselves, what would Jesus do? Well, that question is now at the center of a fierce debate about the economy, with conservatives promoting a small government Jesus and liberals seeing Jesus as an advocate of more programs to help the poor. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
After the House passed its budget last month, liberal religious leaders said the Republican plan, which lowered taxes and cut services to the poor, was an affront to the gospel and especially Jesus' command to care for the poor. Not so, says Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan, who chairs the House Budget Committee. He recently told Christian Broadcasting Network that it was his Catholic faith that helped shape the budget plan. In his view, the Catholic principle of subsidiarity suggests the government should have little role in helping the poor.
Through our civic organizations, through our churches, through our charities, through all of our different groups where we interact with people as a community, that's how we advance the common good.
The best thing that government can do, he said, is get out of the way.
I think that he's completely missing the boat and not understanding the real heart, the real core of Catholic social teaching.
That's Stephen Schneck, a political scientist at Catholic University. He says Catholicism sees everyone as part of a mystical body that serves one another. True, the New Testament does not specifically speak to the government's role.
But charities and individuals and churches can't do it all. When charities are already stretched to their limit, Catholic social teaching expects the state to step up and to fill that gap.
Peter Montgomery at People for the American Way says conservative evangelicals have been arguing for years that the Bible favors a free market system. But since Barack Obama was elected, he says, they've shifted into high gear.
They are finding biblical justification for opposition to progressive taxation, opposition to unions and collective bargaining, oppositions to the minimum wage, opposition even to social welfare spending and social security.
Because, in their view, he says, God intends the government to have a minimal role in society. You heard echoes of that from megachurch pastor Rick Warren, who was asked about the budget recently on ABC's This Week.
The primary purpose of government is to keep the peace, protect the citizens, provide opportunity. And when we start getting into all kinds of other things, I think we invite greater control. And I'm fundamentally about freedom.
Evangelicals cite the Book of Romans, which is one of the few places in the New Testament that refers to civil government. Then there's the conservative resistance to taxation, which some say violates the Eighth Commandment, "Thou shalt not steal." Richard Land at the Southern Baptist Convention says, of course, Jesus paid his taxes and advised followers to do the same. But he says,
the Bible tells us that socialism and neo-socialism never work. Confiscatory tax rates never work.
The Bible never mentions socialism, obviously, but Land says the whole of Scripture says that people are sinful and selfish, and therefore,
people aren't going to work very hard and very productively unless they get to keep a substantial portion of that which they make for them and for their families.
For other religious conservatives, the Bible is a blueprint for a robust capitalism. Recently, on his radio program Wall Builders, David Barton and a guest discussed Jesus' parable of the vineyard owner. In it, the owner pays the worker he hires at the end of the day the same wage as he pays the one who begins work in the morning. Many theologians have long interpreted this as God's grace being available right up to the last minute, but Barton sees the parable as a bar to collective bargaining.
Where were unions in all this? The contract is between an employer and an employee.
Individual
it's not between
relationship.
A group. He went out and hired individually the guys he wanted to work.
Stephen Schneck at Catholic University says many Christians would not recognize this gospel, and he says there are more biblical verses about feeding the hungry and taking care of the least of these. Schneck agrees that the Bible encourages initiative and hard work, but he says theologians through the ages have said there must be a balance.
Pope after pope after pope argued that we're called to be more than market creatures. We're called, in fact, to always bear in mind the common good and our responsibilities to others.
We can probably expect both parties to claim Jesus as their favorite economist in the months to come. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
In this country, economic disaster for some people has become an opportunity for others. The disaster was the wave of home foreclosures in the recession. Some big investors are seizing the chance to turn those homes into rental properties. Chris Arnold reports.
For decades now, you've been able to rent a single-family home in many parts of the country, but most are owned by mom-and-pop landlords. Sometimes it's the nice old guy up the street who owns a couple of rental homes, and some even offer advice on how to do that on the internet.
Buy your own house that you're going to live in, and next you want to buy an extra house that you can rent, and it'll help you make payments on your original house.
But it's not just mom and pops like this anymore. With the collapse of the housing market, some professional investors with a lot of money smell an opportunity. Right now, there are fewer people able to own a house and more people looking to rent. That's driving up the cost of rents. Meanwhile, there's a glut of foreclosed properties being sold on the cheap. Jack McDowell is the chief investment officer of Carrington Capital Management.
We've partnered with a private equity firm looking to deploy $450 million into the rental space.
So McDowell's saying he's looking to spend nearly $500 million buying up foreclosed homes and turning them into rental houses. And he's not alone. Doug Bryan is a managing director of Waypoint Homes in Oakland, California. He's buying in California and around Phoenix.
We've purchased almost 1,300 homes. We actually bought 137 homes last month.
Bryan, it turns out, is actually a retired NFL field goal kicker, mostly with the New Orleans Saints.
So how did you go from kicking in the NFL to this?
You know, the entire time I was playing, I was investing in apartment buildings and learning that business. And when I retired in 2005, I went to work for a real estate investment firm for several years.
And one thing led to another. Bryan co-founded this company, buying up foreclosed homes. And now he's lined up $200 million from an investment firm.
This is a new industry that's unfolding. There are no brands. This is really an unprecedented opportunity for us to come into a new space and be the one to set the bar in terms of how this industry is going to be run.
Still, there will definitely be challenges. Scott Simon is a managing director at PIMCO, a firm that's one of the biggest mortgage bond investors in the world. He says there's a reason that the landlords are mostly mom and pops.
It works really well if you do them in your own neighborhood and you buy five homes and you manage them yourself. It gets a little dicier as you get to 100.
When you get up above 1,000 homes and you're trying to manage 50 broken furnaces, people not paying rents, leaky roofs, spread all over three or four cities.
That scale gets somewhat dubious. The numbers aren't quite as good, but there's a tremendous amount of money in private equity space, for example, that's chasing these sort of investments.
And if it continues to grow, Simon says it's conceivable that these investors could convert a million or more foreclosed homes into rentals. That means these homes wouldn't be sitting there for sale, weighing down the housing market.
And it would take off the excess supply. So it'd actually be a very good thing for single-family housing.
Housing advocates definitely have some concerns, though. Andrew Jakobovics is a policy director with Enterprise Community Partners. It's an affordable housing nonprofit. He says in the past, when speculators have bought up a lot of houses, that sometimes led to problems.
They would slap a coat of paint on the property, stick an unsuspecting household in there, either as renters or as owners, and there would be no maintenance of the property. And so you'd have further deterioration of places that were already hard hit by foreclosures.
So Jakobovics wants to work with the government and investors to develop some safeguards and guidelines. Meanwhile, the government-owned mortgage giant Fannie Mae is starting to gear up to sell thousands of foreclosed properties through bulk sales to investors. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Portugal is the poorest country in Western Europe. And after a financial bailout earlier this year, fees in its health system have risen substantially. NGOs say the poor and elderly can no longer afford essential care. As Lauren Freyer reports from Lisbon, some Portuguese fear that austerity measures now threaten not only their livelihoods, but their lives.
67-year-old Alfredo Silva showed up at an anti-austerity protest last month in Lisbon dressed as a skeleton. He says the costume shows the effect on retirees like him of Portugal's $100 billion bailout.
La culpa, FMI.
I blame the IMF, he says. For me, it means more unemployment, more misery, and more hunger. The Troika and the IMF, more unemployment, he says. Silva's costume is a rather theatrical way to illustrate a serious problem. Portugal's death rate spiked by nearly 20% this winter, mostly among the elderly. The government blames it on a nasty flu strain, but NGOs and opposition politicians say austerity measures are at least partly to blame. Fees for the public health system have doubled in most cases, and a third of Portugal's hospitals are insolvent. At the same demonstration was Francisco Repojo, a 51-year-old public school teacher whose salary was cut by 30%. He's also on dialysis awaiting a kidney operation. And he says patients like him increasingly face a stark choice, food and housing or medicine.
A lot of people had to stop to take the pills. Many people also avoid to go to hospital because they have no money to pay the fees.
The EU and IMF asked Portugal to hike its medical fees as a condition for the bailout that went through earlier this year. Health economist Pedro Pita Baroche describes the changes.
If you go to emergency department in large hospital, you have to pay 20 euros. And if you do some complementary exams like x-rays or CAT scan or something of this sort, you may go up to 50 euros.
That's about $67, which may not seem like a lot to Americans, but Portuguese, like many Europeans, have been used to free universal health care. The new fees are especially burdensome for the elderly, many of whom survive on state pensions that average about $400 a month. Ana Figueres runs the charity Cidadãos del Mundo, which cares for the elderly here in Portugal.
The fact that the health system is not free of charge anymore, the fact that old people, they live alone, a big percentage is poor, and even before, they would not go to the health system because they could not afford for transport. So imagine now, they need to pay for transport and they need to pay the fees. So people decide not to go.
In downtown Lisbon, folk music wafts through cobblestone streets, and an elderly woman hobbles past selling lottery tickets. Nearby, Emmanuel Bakira sells gas canisters for cooking and heating. He says many of his older customers are in arrears.
They don't have money. We have to give him the gas and receive 3 weeks later or more.
Fuel taxes are up too. Gasoline now costs the equivalent of nearly $8 a gallon here. Bakira shows me a stack of pension checks that customers have signed over to him, and he shrugs. The cost of merely surviving keeps going up amid austerity measures. And the only good news here is that winter is just about over. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer.